Are you Milli or are you Vanilli?
Oh, gosh.
You don't even know the difference, do you?
No, I don't know. Which one was which? I don't. Rob and Fab were their names, but...
Rob and Fab.
Right? Fab Morvan and Rob... what was his name?
For the record, I think you should be Fab.
Are you Milli? Wait. Milli... Vanilli.
Those poor people. Oh...
Rob Pilatus. That was his name. Rob Pilatus Fab Morvan.
Okay, that is useless knowledge that I would even let go of.
Rob Pilatus. Rob killed himself. Rob committed suicide.
He did?
Yeah.
After all of this stuff happened, you think?
Yeah.
what a crazy thing.
Yeah, kind of a bummer. In order to restore their career, Farian agreed in 1997 to produce a new Milli Vanilli album with Morvan and Pilatus on lead vocals. This all led up to recording the 1998 Milli Vanilli comeback album, Back and in Attack, which I never heard of.
Entitled Worst Album of All Time.
Right. even some of the original studio singers backed the performers in their attempt to bring back some of the fame that had been shed so quickly. However, Rob Pilatus now encountered a number of personal problems during the production. He turned to drugs and crime, committing a series of assaults and robberies, was ultimately sentenced to 3 months in jail. Wow, I didn't know any of this. And 6 months, they need to do a Behind the Music.
I'm sure there Milli is
Vanilli.
One, no?
There's probably one, isn't there? On VH1 or something?
If there isn't, there's something.
6 months in a drug rehab facility in California, Farian bailed Pilatus out of jail, paid for the rehab and plane tickets to fly him back to Germany. On the eve of the new album's promotional tour on April 2nd, 1998, Pilatus was found dead of a suspected alcohol and prescription drug overdose in a Frankfurt hotel room. Yeesh.
Hey, it's not as bad as, what's his name? Remember we looked him up and he died in a, what was it?
Wait,
the lead singer from some 80s rock, the Warrant guy, Janie Lane, died in like a Days Inn or whatever it was.
Right.
A Red Roof Inn. Anyway, go ahead.
The tour was canceled and Back and in Attack remains unreleased. It has presumably been destroyed.
Could be the best record of all time.
It could be an amazing record. That's the thing, right? It could be an amazing record.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
That's probably not.
No. Although Diane Warren did pen a song for their first record, so maybe she did something for the second record too.
Yeah.
She also did the much maligned but one of my favorite the Star Trek Enterprise theme song.
Nice. All right. I'm assuming we've been recording all this, so we might as well just put it in.
All right.
So pre-show, post-show, now show. Right?
Pro show.
It's October 11th, 2016. And you have tuned in to Behind the Music, Milli Vanilli. it's on Taking Pictures. It's 2:33. I don't know how did we get on Milli Vanilli?
I said Blame It on the Rain and then.
Right. And then Which One Are You? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
By the way, did you know that Pilatus?
Rob Pilatus? Yeah.
Pilatus was quoted as proclaiming himself, quote, the new Elvis, reasoning that by the duo's success, they were musically more talented than Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, and Mick Jagger.
Well, I think history's proved that. Yeah.
Yes, it's really. Yeah.
I mean, I really do. I think, ask anyone.
Sometimes you look at the way things are in the short term and then you look at it how it's in the long term and then you go, yeah, okay. Don't always
and
trust
that, and that was just Vanilli. I mean, imagine if you add Milli into that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Then you're up there.
We should ask her what it was like being in that band.
you're listening to On Taking Pictures cuz, you know, obviously because of the photography talking. Bill Wadman is in New York. In Brooklyn. Jeffrey Sidoris. I am not in the new house. I'm still in the old house.
Is it this old house, though? Is Bob Vila
It is
there?
This old house, right. If you were a real man, you'd know the theme song. But you don't.
Oh, shoot. What is the theme song of this old house? It's been 30 years. Come on. I stopped watching when Bob left.
Yeah. You'd start singing and it would actually probably be like the Golden Girls theme. yeah, so still in the old house. Next week, I'll be in the new house.
Hopefully.
That's me knocking the wood of my desk. Yeah, it,
is that Verizon calling?
Well, it, yeah, that's right. Apparently, getting it's like planning a wedding. You've got to shoot like 6 months out to get Verizon to install something, and then you know perish the thought that you want to remove services. You've got to.
What services are you getting rid of?
We're getting rid of TV for a while and just going internet because the TV is going to be downstairs and we don't know,
You don't need TV.
It's like you got to write an essay on, why you want to remove a service.
Ugh,
well, yeah. I hear that you want to remove it, but if I could just have you talk to my associate, there are some great bundles that might change your mind.
Yeah. Well, want to keep you. Actually, the slick thing to do is even if you don't want to cancel, call and tell them you want to cancel. Talk to them for half an hour, and usually you'll get a rate of 30% off for the next year and a half.
Yeah.
I mean, something to do if you're bored.
We got a pretty good deal. I think it's 100-100 up and down, and they're doing Fios and the whole thing. So hopefully next week's show will be from the new place.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
See if it sounds different. That'll be the interesting part.
Well, it unless I get my acoustic thing solved, it's probably going to be like this from.
It'll be a little tighter than that, but yeah, that's it. It'll be like a little
Bill.
A little quarter inch 30 ips bounce back, like tape delay.
It's going to be interesting. So I'm my goal is to build some new panels between now and then. I bought a ladder yesterday, so that was kind of fun.
Do you have a nail gun?
No. I gave away all that stuff when I moved, so I get to rebuy it all. So that's kind of fun. So no, I'll get a compressor and a brad nailer and I did buy a staple gun because the movers damaged some of the furniture, so I had to do a little bit of upholstery repair yesterday.
This is your theater training coming to roost.
This is absolutely set design, costume design. Yep, this is all that coming back. So I got to tear some upholstery apart on a chair. And
you're the guy you want around at Halloween time. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. Oh, yeah. Don't think the girl has not already tapped that resource. I want wings and I want a horse and I want... okay.
You're like, great.
Okay. Here we go.
Go get some flour and some water and some newspaper.
Yeah. But it's fun. Yeah, it's fun.
All right. What do you want to start? What do you want to talk about?
What do you got going here? You want to talk about the new hardware, or do you want to wait until it actually comes?
Well, it's coming today. Yeah, I ordered a camera. Well,
hope.
Yeah, I ordered the Pentax. So we'll see. Yeah. We'll see when it gets here.
The 645Z.
Yes, as they say everywhere except for here.
Right.
And I ordered one lens, which is the lens that I used on my shoot, which I really liked, which is this wide to normal zoom lens, and I've got a couple more that I'm looking at. So yeah, it's going to be a big shift, and I now have to sell all of my Canon gear. So I put together a price list and I'm going to put it up places today, so we'll see if anybody wants it.
Yeah, it'll be probably on the classifieds if you're a member of the group, Google Plus group. I would imagine we'll have it up there.
Because now I got to find a way to pay for all this stuff that I bought.
Right. You're going to see Bill on a corner in New York City, not taking pictures, though.
Exactly. I'll be holding a camera, but I won't be taking pictures.
Right.
I always think about this stuff because I had long talks with my buddy Claude a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Where Claude is a videographer and he's been looking at this certain RED system and all this stuff, and it's, a couple tens of thousands of dollars and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I was looking at my whole new system, and it's this idea of sort of upping your game and sort of, trying to play in a different league. And
sure.
And we were both kind of sitting there talking and being frustrated by the fact that that is a thing, but then also saying, well, it is a thing. So why are we trying to fight it our whole lives?
Right.
So he and I finally, I jumped and went and ordered the thing, and I sent him a picture of the order, and he just wrote me back. He's like, God damn it. Hey, congratulations.
right.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting, but we'll see what happens.
I'm excited for you. With the caveat that
there's a caveat. Excited for you, but
I'm excited for you, but here's what I want. Here's what I want to see for you. And I know this is, I know this will be true because I think I know you pretty well. I want to see the results of you learning this camera in and out. I want to see, I kind of want to see the tests of you seeing what it's capable of more than I want to see actual work.
Yeah. I plan on writing a little bit about the transition and mm-hmm. putting it on the blog mm-hmm. and stuff. So I think that'll be kind of interesting. And I think I'm going to, maybe not this week and I'm going away next week, but when I get back, sort of start a little environmental portrait series where I just go to people and shoot them just to basically to get the feel of the thing in situations mm-hmm. where somebody's not paying me, you know?
Right. And maybe, you know, maybe one time you do it natural. Maybe then you do it, beauty dish. Then you
see what happens. And figure out, it's the interesting thing about cameras, and this is true of my current Canon and will be true of this thing, I'm sure, is that what you see on the screen, you can't always trust what you see on the screen. And there's a certain point at which you start to have an intuitive sense of what can be done with the file that you see on the screen. You know, mm-hmm. you're looking at it and you go, okay, yeah, it's a little clipped and it's a little dark than the shadows. Yeah, but that's fine. I can deal with that.
Yeah. But now you've got to relearn that.
Exactly. I have to start from scratch and know that when I see something on the screen, it looks great. And then I bring it in and it's blown out or it's way too dark. I go, oh, I got to recalibrate my whole way of thinking and make sure the histograms are pushed up here and do that. So that's actually going to be part of the interesting process of all of this. Mm-hmm. It's getting used to what is a wholly different instrument. It's like, you know, playing a different guitar, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the action's going to feel different. Everything, all that's going to feel different. It's a big change for me because I've been using these Canon cameras since the beginning.
Sure. So, and arguably not much has changed in terms of look and feel of those cameras.
No, in fact, the controls and everything have been virtually identical for, 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's part of what people like about all that camera stuff,
sure.
right? Where it's like, it's just the same and everything's fine. It's not that this particular camera has any crazy ergonomic niggles, you know, like if anything, everyone always says it's wonderful the way everything's laid out. So it's just getting used to new stuff again and whatnot. So I'll let you know. I'll keep you guys in the loop. It'll be fun.
Cool. I had some fun with a beauty dish. Since last we spoke.
What'd you stick in the beauty dish?
A young Nuo 560.
Okay, I just stuck a little speed light in there.
Which worked. Yeah, I got this beauty dish when Freddie got it from Freddie Clark, who is now in Paris. Hi, Freddie.
Oh, Paris.
Right. Well, you know, when you're Freddie Clark, the world is your oyster. So, you know, he's out. But he upgraded some lighting gear and said, hey, I needed a beauty dish for a specific part of the book. And he said, hey, I've got one just sitting here. So in fact, he gave it to me on the camping trip. Remember we went camping
in New
Jersey?
Yeah, how big is it?
22 inch.
Okay, sure.
With a sock and a grid.
Sure.
So I grabbed Fielding and shot some.
How'd you like the beauty dish?
You know, I like it. I like that kind of hard but soft. Well, what they like call hard but soft.
It's a big hard source. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we kind of messed around with it. You know, with the sock on. With I don't see a lot of difference sock on, sock off. I mean, there's a little more diffusion, but it's not real dramatic.
Part of that could be, do you have a like a diffuser on the end of your speed light, or are you just firing it straight into the plate?
Firing it bare, straight
yeah,
in.
Yeah, so I think that some of the thing with a beauty dish is the fact that the flash tube is in there and firing in all directions, so it's hitting that plate that's blocking it from going mm-hmm. direct to the subject, but it's also going straight out to the sides where you're basically getting reflected off the plate into the dish out. You know what I mean? Like you're not getting any, it's not spilling out the sides of the light. So that could be changing it a little bit. So in some ways it may be more contained the way you're doing it or mm-hmm. less of a difference with the sock, but yeah.
I'll tell you, I really like it with a grid. That's a neat effect.
That's where it's at. In fact, I pretty much only like beauty dishes with grids.
Yeah, I love it. So that's been a lot of fun. Been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's good stuff. The all right, so you've got this you've got the house you're moving into.
Yeah.
So when we finished last week,
yeah,
I said something. God, what did I say the way I put it? I said, you know, you know, you're on the East Coast, you're married, you got the house, you got the whole thing, you got everything set up. Right?
Yeah. I don't know what more I can do.
Well,
I think I'm done.
Well, that's exactly it, right? Is that, and I'm in a similar thing except for the house, because, you know, I don't have $3 million to buy something in Brooklyn.
Right.
But there's this sense of, okay, I always feel this way when young people are getting out of high school and going to college, and then they get out and they get their first job, and then they get married, and then they have a kid. There's a certain point at which you kind of run out of things that you're supposed to do. And then you have to sort of decide what it is that you want to do. And that's a different question. And I think it would be interesting to discuss a little bit about the idea of, like, once you've got it all figured out, once you've got your game plan, now how do you figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life? And we can take this from an artistic point of view, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So the first reaction is the sense of place, the sense of home, the sense of belonging, and what that all means has been something that I have struggled with for the bulk of my life.
Right.
The combined with the idea of deserving or not deserving, or, you know, whether that's happiness, comfort, love, whatever. These things have been core to my being since I was a child. So on the one hand, to have these things kind of, and not to sound glib about it, but to have those boxes checked,
right,
has allowed me in the past few months to what I've come to call existentially exhale, because I do feel at home here. I do feel like I deserve this. I do feel like I don't have to eat up processor cycles with the stuff that I've eaten up processor cycles on for the past 40 years.
That's exactly my point. Yep.
So there, in the last several months, there has been maybe not an explosion or an eruption, but certainly a more continual outpouring of ideas. Now that I have this time, that I'm not angsting over belonging, or I'm not angsting over, do I deserve this?
Right. Okay.
Whatever this might be. Huh?
Yeah. Yep.
So the short answer is, I don't know what to do with the days. I don't know what's coming, but I do know that they're not going to be spent in such sort of emotional angst or turmoil.
Right.
You know, before I left, I mean, you and I talked about this online and off, a lot offline at the time. I was in a really dark place.
Right. Yep.
You know, and you were one of the people that really helped with that I talked to a lot. I mean, before I left California, everything just felt so heavy. And I couldn't have planned out how my life has unfolded in the last year and a half. I couldn't have planned it. So it's got me thinking about all sorts of things.
I think there's two things there. There's the idea of, okay, this stuff all has happened, now what? But there's also the idea of, does it change the way that you think about things happening to you, or the way you let things happen? Does that make sense?
Like, not really. How do you mean?
Okay. You said a year and a half ago, you could not have planned that this stuff, you'd be where you are right now today.
Right.
Although you would rather be in the new house today, but put that right aside for the moment.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine that I wasn't going to be in my house.
but what I mean is that in the same way that you say that you couldn't have planned it, well, maybe the not planning it is why you're here today, and letting events choose you as much as you obsessing and choosing them is part of the equation.
Absolutely. Now, I don't think it was a, you know, let Jesus take the wheel moment, but I do think that I know.
His name is Jesus.
Right.
He's your driver, Jeffrey. It's all right.
I'm sorry. Jesus. There was a moment of abandoning.
Letting go of the reins?
Yeah. Yeah. And whether you choose to call that, you know, God or Vishnu or Brahman or Muhammad or, you know, whatever the name is that you associate with it, there was that moment of getting so frustrated that I just have to let go of the ship and see and let the ship take me where it needs to go.
Well, there's also an argument that of whether or not holding onto the reins tightly changes anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure. I think you and I are tend to be the kind of people who think about stuff too much, who obsess about decisions, who have a hard time going. In fact, look, a small version of that last week when I actually won the auction on the camera, I instantly called you and I said, I just won this $1,000 auction on this camera. Tell me that I did the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was great. There was this. Yeah. Listeners, their phone rings. I answer the phone.
You should hit record.
I didn't look at it. Right. So I didn't know it was Bill. And there's this moment of silence. Jeffrey, I need you to talk me down. I just bought this camera.
You know, because I just spent $5,000 on a piece of gear that great. I don't really need.
And you could hear it in your voice. And honestly, it was, no disrespect, but it was one of the most honest moments we have had in a while, where there was just, it was like half excitement, half panic of, please tell me I didn't just totally screw the pooch on this.
Yeah, know? Right?
It was great. It was great.
But there's this element. So you and I obsess about this stuff a lot. But
sure.
And it's, you know, it goes back to that conversation I was having with Claude, where it's like, I think that if you and I take this metaphorical leap,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not like the end of the world, but like, I'm more nervous about this than I was about getting married. You know, that's,
yeah.
And I guess that shows that I was more sure about getting married, or like, you know, that was not a terrifying thing to me. But at the same time, I think that a year from now, we're going to be looking back and saying, why were we, in the same way that people are terrified when they're in high school of going to college.
Sure.
And then you get to college and you look back and you go, it was high school. It's no big deal. It's just college.
Marriage doesn't define you though, Bill. Your marriage isn't.
My camera does define me.
Your work defines you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that might be it, right? That
your
might
work
be.
Defines you. You are, and again, no disrespect, because I am very much the same way. What you do in many ways trumps who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Or yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that
not always,
but that's definitely part of it. Right.
Mm-hmm,
and, but so the idea of, you know, holding on and trying to figure all this stuff out, at a certain point, it's just like, F it, you know, like what difference does it make? I'm going to die in 30 years anyway, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I might as well just live, you know,
but instead of saying what's, you know, a lot of people say, what's the worst that can happen? Okay. Yeah.
What's the best that can happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
what's
right.
the best
yeah.
that can happen?
Yeah. This could allow me to do X, Y, Z. It's like, all right, well, get the thing that allows you to do X, Y, Z and give it a shot. What are you going to sit around like wondering whether or not it's a good idea later? Like, the hell with it, you know, move on. So I think that, it's interesting that I think that there's an illusion of control that you and I both have, that we think by thinking about it a lot, we're going to come up with a better answer.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Or by stressing about it, you're actually going to affect the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're putting English on the ball by stressing.
Yeah. And you know? I don't know if that's the case. I mean, you and I have both kind of, you more so in terms of selling prints. I just put up some prints.
Right.
And, you know, they didn't sell. And then one sold, and yep. then another, and then another. And I remember Wilkening called me the day that one sold, and he is so wise beyond his years. He was very calmly. He just said, "Well, now you know it's not impossible."
Right. Yeah.
And it was just that, you know, that smack of you're right.
Yep.
If you do one, you can do five. If you do five, you can do 10. If you do 10, you can do 100. You know, there is that
100 million.
Yeah, there is that, but there is that thing about
sure.
Now you know it's possible.
Yep. Yeah. And I wonder if. Let me ask you a question. So you said that you're now not obsessing about knowing where you are, having a place. Is that a
I'm not obsessing. It's still in my head. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's like quitting smoking or stopping, right. Quitting meat or something. Yep. You don't go cold turkey by and large.
You still have the honeymoon excitement of being in a new place and figuring that all out. And you know what I mean? Like you're in the middle of the fun part of having a new place.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I guess my question is, do the things that you, not just how much time you have to think about the, I don't know, creative concepting, for lack of a better word, the making stuff, do mm-hmm. you find yourself thinking about different stuff to make?
Yes, or is it, absolutely.
Okay. So talk absolutely. About that a little bit.
My days are filled with analog at the moment. I couldn't give a shit about digital at the moment,
right?
Other than the way it fits into an analog workflow, the idea of, and sorry for the expletive, but
I'll get it.
The idea of having a place that I can work with my hands again, that I don't have to worry about splattering paint all over or, you know, dumping epoxy or, you know, whatever it is, I'm trying to navigate that map of sort of where to go. The downstairs workshop, studio, whatever you want to call it, is going to be for making. There's no computer there. It's just benches, tools, paper, canvas, paint.
Right.
You know, it's my hands need to be in motion and not clicking if I'm down there.
Yep.
And to have that space is such a gift. And to know where it came from. That's the other thing, is I feel a responsibility to the house. I feel a responsibility to the owner, the previous owner.
Sure.
Who built this house with his hands, with his father. They built this thing. They didn't just, I mean, they built it. And there are touches of what he wanted where throughout the house.
Yep.
And because he was not only a woodworker, but an engineer, there are so many little touches where you go, oh yeah, that totally makes sense.
Right.
Oh
right.
Yeah. Why? Huh. Why aren't all houses, you know, there are so many little things like that. And I feel this odd sense of responsibility to not only care for that home that they built, but continue making. That it would be disrespectful to the house if I didn't make something in the house.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't know where that comes from.
Well, that, I don't like the term, but it's a ghost in the house, you know?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
And I think that is, sometimes I find myself, not requiring, but being pushed by external forces is a good thing, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't mean other people yelling at me. I mean, you know, this
although that does happen, to be clear.
Yeah. And that works too. But there's a certain feeling of, oh, well, you know, yeah, I've got to live up to somebody else's opinion of me, mm-hmm. I think is a driver, you know. And I think that you're thinking that, you know, whether or not this guy's coming and checking in on you, there's a worry of, hey, Jeffrey, I just want to see what you did in my workshop downstairs.
Yeah, I don't want him to be disappointed with me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There
yeah.
is that.
Yeah. This guy is like some sort of, I don't know, maybe I'm going too far here, but like strangely idealized father figure kind of guy, right? Like he's this.
Yeah. Grandfather figure. Sure.
Yeah, sure. You know? And I totally get that.
You know, and It, remember when we talked about the Dan Winters, that photo essay that he did for Smithsonian Magazine about the guy that went off to World War II and then just came back and resumed his life?
Dan who? I've never heard of that guy.
Dan what? I don't remember. I think it was the January edition of Smithsonian Magazine.
Okay.
Roy Halliburton was his name. Anyway. That era,
Roy. Oh, Roy Ray, Halliburton. It's Ray Halliburton. Sorry,
Ray Halliburton.
Yep.
That era of men that, you know, the former owner was very much like that. He was living his life. World War II happened. He answered the call to go serve his country. He came back and resumed his life, and was a maker. Was I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. I'm kind of stuttering, obviously, but that era of man is gone. You know, men that used to carry pocket knives.
Yeah. Do you aspire to be one of these men?
I don't aspire to, but I.
You aspire to live up to their.
Yes. I want to respect. I want to respect what came before me and sort of in some way. I want my creative life to be an homage to what they were, or my perception of what they were. My grandfather was the same way. My grandfather built and made and was tough, but compassionate, and, you know, smoked a pipe, carried a pocket knife. I don't know. Again, it's hard to verbalize it. It's just a feeling of what I imagine he was like, never having... Right. You know, known him other than at settlement.
Can I throw a little devil's advocate in?
Yeah, here? Yeah, sure, okay. Sure.
I agree with you, and I understand all the things you're saying. There are also people who would say, well, yes, but this is the same generation of men who couldn't talk to their sons in any real way and couldn't.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Like, so there's, some of them. Absolutely.
There's upsides and downsides to that sort of mentality, right? Like, I think sometimes certain people's certain ways of life become idealized over time. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm either projecting or associating my brief interaction with him with the memory of my own grandfather.
Yeah. Right.
Who not only was this tough guy, he was in his younger days, he made moonshine and was a pool hustler and then worked this blue collar job his entire life at the railroad.
The man is literally a myth. Right. I mean, I'm saying, like, his life is a myth in your head, at least.
Absolutely.
Right? He's Paul
Absolutely.
Bunyan.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And in a way that even somebody like your father, being just one generation closer to you, who you actually knew much better, you realize that your father was many things, but he wasn't some weird idealized version of that thing, where your grandfather could be because he was removed enough that that's the way you saw him, you know?
Sure. So that, in effect, I'm honoring the myth.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you ever worry though that you're trying to live up to an impossibility?
All the time. Right. I mean, come on.
Right. Right.
Have you forgotten who you're talking about? All the time. Yeah.
That would be my only sort of like, whoa, slow down there, friend. don't set yourself up to not be able to live up to perfection or
I don't think it's perfection.
Well,
but it's
your own view of what it is that you want to be that may or may not be realistic in today's world.
Sure.
Or but maybe it was never realistic in the old world either. Who knows, right?
Yeah, maybe it wasn't, right? Right. That's the other thing, is maybe it was never real to begin with.
Right. Right.
But I little things, you know, fixing, you know, mending the torn upholstery, fixing the bathroom mirror.
You know what I did the other day? I actually went outside on the fire escape and washed the windows from the outside.
There you go.
And I was just like, you know what? I've lived here for 13 years. I don't think I've ever actually gone outside and hand washed the windows. You know what I mean? Like, because it's the kind of thing you don't really think to do most of the time. And then I was like, you know, those are really dirty. I need to do something about it right now. Where's a bucket and a big giant, you know, scrubber, you know?
But there is something to that, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I ran into a couple neighbors. I've met, let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I've met 8 people so far in the neighborhood, all of whom have been remarkably welcoming and all of whom have had terrific things to say about the previous owners. And you know, they said, oh, yeah, last year, last winter, Hank was out with his snowblower, you know, blowing the driveway out at 95. You know, and we said, hey, we got a tractor. We can do that for you. No, I've got it.
Yeah.
There's
just
that impetus to do.
Yep.
Whatever it is to earn your place. And that's what I want to do.
Do you think that there, okay.
Mm.
I'm going to swerve just a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
I
should have made more coffee. You really put me on the spot here.
Sorry. I agree with all the things you said, and in many ways I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand everything, and I agree with 90% of it. Do you think, okay, there has been this transition though to, say, digital tools, right? This is part of your life and my life and the way we see the world and how we have to do it. There's also this backlash, this desire to, at least in ways that you can, realize that digital isn't always the perfect tool for something. Therefore, sometimes we need analog stuff. Even if the analog thing is as simple as we're going to print this out with a digital printer, but now it is an analog object that lives in the world. And now we have a print and this is a thing. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
My question is, do you think that as the world progresses and the digital stuff takes over even more than it already has, mm-hmm. that there will be a point at which it sort of wraps around and becomes organic again? You know, where the digital becomes nuanced enough that it feels analog to us in the same way
know.
That, yeah, that's yeah.
Because it's always going to be an approximation. You said digital isn't perfect, but the problem is, for me, digital is perfect.
Mm.
There's no sort of fail with digital. It's either, it's binary. It's either on or it's off.
Yeah, but there's a thing. I'll go with audio just because it's an easy thing to explain. Easy to explain. It's how my mind works.
Right.
You know, the early digital audio sounded like crap, like 8-bit audio, like on your old Sound Blaster. You know, you had when you were whatever 25 or whatever the hell it was.
Right, on your IBM PC XT.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Obviously sounded like crap. CDs come out, okay, 16-bit, okay, we have enough information where it sounds pretty good, certainly way better than cassettes and all the rest of it do, arguably in its best modes as good as, you know, analog records. I'm not getting into this argument, but like there, it could be argued. You get into high bit rates, you get into 24-bit, you get into DSD, like the Sony format that Super Audio CDs, where what it is a bit stream of ones and zeros, one if the signal went up, zero if the signal goes down. So what this bitstream looks like is 0 0 0 0 0 0 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 quotable. It's so obviously, it's almost analog. It's like on the edge. And when you listen to audio recorded that way, it doesn't sound like a digital recording. It sounds like a perfect analog recording. So,
but it's still not subject to
fault.
No, it's subject to fault, but the fault has to be an exceptional fault. It's still not, you know, if
right
with an analog camera, if the light seal on the top left corner is starting to fail, it doesn't completely fail. There's a whole scale of how it's going to fail or how it will fail. And it gets worse and worse. Whereas digital, if the pixel is stuck, it's either stuck or it's not stuck.
Right,
it's not partially stuck.
But there's an argument that all the time of people using analog, whether it's analog tools being an analog camera or an analog chisel or, you know, a laser cutter versus a chisel, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What you were trying to do is reach perfection through the analog tool.
Yes.
And never being able to get there. Right, exactly.
And in the imperfection is where beauty lies.
Okay, well that's right. That's the way that your mind goes, right?
Yeah, exactly. For other people, a pristine edge to edge sharp, perfectly exposed, stacked exposure
Right, right.
That's going to be their perfection. For me, maybe it's that natural vignette of the glass. Maybe it's, right. you know, again, a light leak in the corner of the frame. It's, but perfection is not perfect for me.
Yeah, right, right. I guess everyone has their own definition of what perfection is, which mm-hmm. is kind of ironic. Or rather, we both know what perfect means, but some people are turned off by the lack of perfection, and some people are turned on by that.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I took pictures of a photographer named Melissa Rivera the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And she came over here and we were talking, and she used to be a film shooter, a 6-4-5 film shooter. And she used to scan with an Imicon scanner and do the whole thing. And she and I were talking, and she was like, "Oh, what are you shooting with now?" I said, "Oh, this 5D." I was like, "It's funny. This might actually be the last time that I actually take pictures with this camera." So, and she was talking how she uses this Nikon D810 or whatever it is, D800E. And I was like, "It's a beautiful camera." I was like, "She's like, yeah." She's like, "It's amazing, and it's gotten to the point where I will shoot medium format sometimes, and I'll go and I'll scan it on a good scanner, and I'll open it up, and I go, you know, and I got to spot all the dust and all the rest of it, and then I end up with something that looks very much like what I get straight out of my digital camera. It's like the digital camera has come around to the point where it's for her. Mm-hmm. I'm not speaking for everybody, where the additional time with the other stuff." Is not time enjoyed. It's time. It's a grind, not a bliss.
Sure. You know? And again, it's, you know,
absolutely. What you're going for.
Yeah, it depends on where you find your joy.
Yep. Yep.
You know, if your joy is in lighting and tweaking lights and making the exposure, and that's one area. If you're Brooke Shaden, your joy is.
Yeah.
Taking simple photographs and making them extraordinary in post-processing.
Yep. I think that Dan Winters is a good example, because he obviously likes a lot of analog stuff. I'm sure he shoots digital sometimes too, but he likes the analog stuff. He likes large format. But when I look at his pictures, I feel like he's trying to find technical perfection within the analog domain. You know, there's not a lot of technical flaws or anything that would make you say something is analog in his stuff, in the way that you're describing analog in Dan's pictures.
Yeah, you know, maybe not. Maybe not.
And so it's interesting that I understand where he's coming from. Like, I understand the motivation and the feel that he has, and mm-hmm. it kind of, I'm not envious of it, but I respect it immensely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And just trying to find what it is that makes you want to get up in the morning, you know?
Yeah. I'm eager to get some of this stuff underway. My recording and computer and that kind of room will now be upstairs in the light for the last. Right. For the last year plus, I've been down in the basement in a small room. I mean, it's a dead room, which is great for recording.
Yeah.
But there's no windows. So it feels sort of dark and cloistered away from the rest of the house, which in some ways has been a good thing. But I'm curious to see thematically what changes in either podcasting or writing or, you know, my own post-processing or photographic life versus the analog studio space that's going to be downstairs. I'm curious to see how those are going to take shape.
Right.
And I'm eager to get started.
Yeah. I am not, I'm not uninterested as well. I'm excited to see what happens. It's, yeah. Hey, let's leave this efficiency of effort for next time, because I think that's an interesting conversation.
Yes, and I actually took some notes around that. So yeah,
okay. Well, let's talk about that next week then.
Okay.
What's up with Barry Gibb?
Barry Gibb.
Other than being awesome, awesome.
Yeah. Barry Gibb is awesome. fascinating article on the New York Times about Barry Gibb. He's got a new record coming out, and he talks, excuse me, he talks very openly about, on many levels, the guilt he has around being the last BG, around being the last brother alive, because he's the oldest. Andy died very young, 30 years old, and yeah. Then Morris, and then Robin. He talks about feeling like he should have gone first.
Yeah.
And that his, how strange his life has been. It's just interesting. It's an interesting interview. The record, the new record is, the song is called All I Think About Is Yesterday.
Oh God.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Thanks,
and,
Barry.
Yeah. Thanks, Barry. So much for Night Fever. but the article reads, two earlier solo attempts by Mr. Gibb were never released. The Kid's No Good, recorded in 1970, whose masters were lost, and an unnamed work in the late 80s, Mr. Gibb's sole previous solo effort to be issued, now Voyager, arrived in 1984.
Hey, in a sense, I just point out, the unnamed work in the late 80s may have been the Milli Vanilli album that got lost.
That's true. So
move on.
Barry just Gibb was both Milli and Vanilli.
I'm making the connection in the middle there. Go ahead.
In a sense, even the new album came by default. Quote, it would never have crossed my mind that someday I'd be in this situation where there was no one else around to make music with, end quote, the singer said.
Ugh.
So, I mean, this. Imagine you've spent your life making music with these other people who are also your brothers.
Yep.
And now you're the only one left. It's just, I don't know, it's just weird.
Sad.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the end of the career kind of thing, and not saying Barry's like his career's over, but he's obviously in the second half of his career.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Glenn Campbell movie in that last song that he wrote, you know?
Oh, right.
Like what, I Won't Remember You or whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
like, oh,
I won't,
God. Yeah. It's like, my God, there's something so... Look, death is part of life. Melancholy needs to be there in order for bliss and happiness to be there. You know, I mean, I understand the contrast in life.
Yeah.
But just the idea of going through what these, in this case, gentlemen are going through, it tears me up.
Robin never told Barry that he was sick.
Why?
It's in the article. He says, you wrote the song End of the Rainbow, which appears on the new album for Robin, though he never told you directly that he was dying of cancer. Was there resentment over him withholding that information? And Barry responds, I suppose there is, but I try to put myself in his place and maybe I wouldn't tell him either. Yeah. Robin didn't want to be treated as an invalid. He denied that he was sick until it was obvious visibly. Robin was passing and I came to the hospital in London and sang the song to him, although he was in a coma. I don't know whether or not he heard it, but it helped me.
Ugh.
Right?
Yeah. I remember the night my father died, his three older brothers were there. And I remember saying to one of them, you know, did you guys ever imagine, because my father's the youngest, I said, did you ever imagine that he would be the first to go? And two of them said, no, we thought it would be him, and pointed to the third, my Uncle Bob.
Right.
Who was like in the middle, but kind of like lived hard for many years. Who's still alive, by the way. But, and it's like this strange, is it like survivor guilt almost?
Right.
You know?
Right.
But at the same time, I totally understand the idea of, I'm dying. I don't want to talk about me dying for the rest of my life.
Sure. Well, I mean, we saw it with Freddie Mercury famously.
Right.
You know, look, I've got this thing. I don't know how long I've got, as he's telling the rest of the band, but let's put aside all the crap and let's just make as much music as we can.
Right, let's not talk
about it. You know,
it kind of makes you wonder why the crap ends up infiltrating everything for the rest of your life. Everyone knows this is coming, Jeffrey. You know what
mm-hmm,
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, most people don't want to think about it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to whatever. But you think that, that the fear that keeps you from thinking and talking about it should be the same thing that would keep you positively looking forward in your life that
right.
you do have.
It would seem to be the thing that keeps the crap at bay.
Right. And I had a friend of mine turned 40 the other night, and there was like a little party at a bar, and Conrad and I went out, and our friend Ron and his dad is this older gentleman named Big Ron. You know, he's the father.
Big Ron.
And I had met Ron before, and you know, he's this African-American gentleman who's lived in Park Slope his whole life, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And super cool. This guy's like, you know, one of those like, hey, how you doing? You know?
Right.
Big
Ron is actually Barry White.
Exactly. How's it going, Bill? Close the door. Oh, that's Teddy
He's Teddy Pendergrass.
Let me rub your back where you say it's sore. Anyway, Big Ron and I and a couple women there were sitting there talking, and he said, you know, like, look, you got your health. You know, it's that old you got your health comment, right?
Sure, sure.
But funny enough, the older you get, the more you realize that, well, at least you got your health really is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way that you don't really think about it when people say it when you're 20.
Right.
Yeah, it's sad. I do feel for Barry Gibb. It's also interesting that Barry Gibb was always sort of the brains of the Bee Gees, right? I mean, he's the guy who wrote all the songs, and he's the Lionel Richie of the
sure.
Bee Gees.
Surprisingly, in the article, they also say that he and Robin were very competitive, and Robin was so soft-spoken that kind of surprised me. I didn't realize that.
She's just like yelling at Barry in a high-pitched voice.
Right.
Why? Why do you treat me this way?
Yeah.
I don't know, Robin. I just do.
Yeah, it's exactly that. But I feel like they're in the same way that if all of the Beach Boys died and the only one left was Brian Wilson, he'd be sitting here thinking, wow, I sort of started all this. I'm the one who was keeping the engine running because
right.
ultimately it's my crazy creative energy that's keeping this thing on the tracks.
Yeah, sure.
And then everyone else kind of gets off and you're just like, now I'm on the train all alone. You know, why am I bothering to push?
Right.
And I think that there must be an element of wanting to keep going, but also an urge to say, well, it's over. They're not here anymore. And I was doing it because I wanted to do it with them. And now I have to rejigger the whole thing because now I have to be doing it for different reasons, perhaps. And
yeah,
recalibrating your life at age, whatever he is now.
Yeah, I think that would be a fascinating conversation of why are you doing this now versus 30 years ago, 20 right. years ago, 10 years
him
ago?
Him or anybody?
Well, specifically him. I think he'd be an interesting conversation. Are there markers throughout your career that to your point, you've had to kind of recalibrate the why? Because you certainly don't need the money.
Right. Yeah. As far as we know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Good point. Good point.
But yeah, I'm sure Barry Gibb's doing just fine.
Yeah.
The whys of why people, anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. I just thought it was kind of an interesting article.
I've always liked the Bee Gees.
Good. Yeah.
I've always liked the Bee Gees. Barry Gibb is a hell of a songwriter.
Yeah.
There's that, Dionne Warwick song that he wrote, the "Why Do You Have to Be a Heartbreaker?"
Sure, sure.
And he wrote a bunch of Streisand songs and stuff. I mean, Barry Gibb's been around beyond the other stuff. What else?
Yeah,
you got?
He did more than just Saturday Night Fever, right?
Yeah.
Oh, there he goes.
Hey, did you know that the drums on that song are a loop?
Nope.
And that if you listen to it, it's just the, you know, and cymbal hits go over the top of the loop. Apparently, they went down to Montserrat or wherever the hell people went back in the day
to Eddie Grant's studio down
exactly.
there.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
To record the record. And the drummer, they did one take, and the drummer got a phone call and his mother had died or something.
This is the
apocryphal story. I don't know if it's true. And the guy had to leave. And they were like, well, that was a great groove he had going. And so they cut out one measure of it and they looped it around. They put mic stands with tape reels on them and looped it around through the tape machine and recorded a bunch of it. And not only that, it's on two other songs on that record and on a song on a later Bee Gees record or somebody else's
record. The same groove.
The same exact drum loop.
Wow.
So it was like one of the first like real like straight ahead, this is a loop and we're just going to let it go the whole time.
Wow.
So yeah, little piece of trivia there. Yeah. So I see you put in a PDN online article, which is actually a paid ad, but we're going to talk about it because it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a sponsored thing.
It is sponsored by Canon, yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I first saw the work of Sue Bryce.
Yep.
She's a pretty famous boudoir and portrait photographer. She's on Creative Live quite a bit. But this particular article around printing kind of fascinated me because you and I have both, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have struggled with how to get prints out there, what makes a good print sale, what do you price them at, what do you offer? And she talks about having sort of gallery style shows at the portrait sessions so people can see what they look like in print and how it's upped her print game in terms of sales.
Right. So the idea is that you hire her, you come in, you get your pictures taken. When you come back a day later to look at everything, she's printed out a dozen or two,
right?
Put them on the wall so you can see them in print. The idea is that you're going to buy some of the prints.
That's right.
The basic gist. Okay.
Yeah. And I thought that was kind of fascinating. And I wanted to ask you about it in terms of doing personal portraiture or doing personal projects. Is this something that you could see fitting into your workflow? Do you think it would help?
See, for me, it's a little different in the sense that 80% of the time I'm taking pictures of somebody for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I am taking pictures of somebody for them, it's not a vanity thing as much as it is a necessity thing. I'm an author. I need a photo, you know, for my thing. It's not like, Joe Schmo author is going to take my picture and put it up on their own wall. Mm-hmm. Her thing is more of this people wanting to come in for vanity pictures of themselves, you know?
Right.
And so I totally understand that from a business point of view.
Yeah.
It always reminds me of, wedding, and this isn't to slag her, it's just the, whenever I see this kind of thing, I always think about wedding photographers and some wedding photographers I've known who have done this for a long time talk about how they make more money on print sales than they do on the shooting a lot of times, or at least they
mm-hmm.
used to.
Mm-hmm.
Where I don't know how that works anymore, but that's how it was. I guess the idea is it costs me, let's say it costs $3 or $4 to make each one of these prints, $3 say to make each one of these prints.
Mm-hmm.
She prints out 24 of them. She spends $100 on printing. And if she sells two of these prints at $75 a piece, she's coming out ahead, even if she throws 2/3 of them out.
Right.
You know, that's sort of that kind of thing.
I just thought it might help jumpstart maybe some of the listeners to kind of get their print sales going. Cause I know we've got a lot of listeners that do personal.
Yeah. No,
like for not commercial, they do personal portraiture or personal sessions or.
I think it's a really neat way of, I think part of it is that most people don't see prints of photos anymore, you know,
mm-hmm.
especially
mm-hmm.
photos that they're in or have been hired by. And, you know, especially with most, say, computer screens, where if you're looking at it on anything other than a really high DPI screen, it's not looking that good anyway. And the print will look magnificently better than what you're going to get looking at it on a screen. So you could imagine coming in and saying, oh, that looks like the cover of a magazine,
mm-hmm.
which is what they're going for this woman for, essentially.
Sure. Right? Sure. They're going, and they say it in the piece, they're going for these sort of Vanity Fair type of
yes.
of, looking.
Yeah. So I think it's a really cool idea. I mean, it's also, you know, good for Canon, I guess, to sell printers.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can do it with Epson. It doesn't matter.
You know. No. I'm just saying that, like, it makes sense that a printer company is saying this is a good idea because it is a possible revenue stream, as they put it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Pretty cool stuff.
So yeah, just a quick thing. That's
yep.
all.
No, it's cool. WTF on Marin's podcast.
Yep,
photographer Larry Clark.
Right.
Of Tulsa and Kids the movie and Ken Park the movie and a bunch of other stuff. Is on there and talks for an hour and a half, and I've never been a huge fan of Larry Clark's work. Part of it, I think we talked about him back in like episode 40 or something like that.
Right.
As our photographer of the week. But you know, most of his shots, for those of you who don't know, he's sort of famous for this book Tulsa from the early 60s, where he went back to Oklahoma, where him and his friends used to take Benzedrine and stick it in water and suck off the meth and shoot up meth before meth was meth.
Right.
Essentially.
Meth before meth.
Right.
Yeah. Right. BM.
Amphetamines before meth was a thing. And
right.
And some of the pictures are really hard to see. It's like, you know, a bunch of naked 20-year-old kids shooting up and having sex and playing with guns. And
yeah, I'm not a fan.
Right? But let me ask you
a
question.
It's just painful. It's emotionally painful.
Yeah, okay. Is that why you don't like them? You could say that that's him being successful at what he's doing, no?
Maybe. I just don't. I find these photographs hopeless.
Yes. Yeah.
And
you don't enjoy looking at them, even if they're well done or
no.
Or
no disrespect to the technical quality or being in the moment or, you know, none of that. I just don't find them
pleasing,
appealing
to look at. Yeah. You know what? Can we? I have a couple more things to say, but if you guys are out there and have seen these pictures, or go take a look at some pictures from Tulsa, and feel that we're off base not liking them, I'd like to hear how other people see it. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
How they justify enjoying it, for lack of a better word. It's a terrible way of putting it, but you know what I mean.
I mean, there are a few pictures in there that I liked. I remember looking through it, and there are a few that are interesting. But the stuff where the kids are just
shooting up,
it doesn't look like they're enjoying themselves. It looks like he's documenting despair.
Yeah. Apparently, he says in the interview that most of the people in the book ended up becoming criminals, going to prison, becoming prostitutes. Like this group of people that he came back to see, it ended up becoming a giant mess.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, I find it very hard to look at. And
some of his other work, I actually really like. But
the movies and stuff, or other photography?
Other photography. Okay. But the Tulsa work is just, you know, it's like a certain body of work by Nan Golden. I like some of her stuff, but then other
the stuff
other
that she's famous
work,
for is the stuff I'm not a big fan of.
Yeah, other bodies of work are just difficult to look at.
Anyway, if you want to go listen to him, and I found it interesting hearing him talk. A different way of looking at him, and not that I like his work now, but I have a little more respect for the way he sees things, and he's very obviously a pretty serious, long-term on and off drug addict in many ways. So it's interesting to hear him tell his story and his side of it, and the way that he was. Apparently both of his parents were baby photographers, his mother especially.
Like Sears portrait studio kind of thing.
Yeah. They used to go door to door and set up a little background and stick the kid on a coffee table and take pictures. And so he always had a camera, and he used to shoot babies when he was like younger, in his teenage years. And so when he started shooting other stuff, he's like, oh, I don't have to take pictures of babies. I can take pictures of whatever I want. Well, me and my friends have been shooting up since we're 15, you know, and you're like, oh my God, you know, you're listening to the stories and it's pretty rough.
Yeah.
But anyway, just, I thought it would be interesting for people to hear that. So go check it out. Larry Clark on WTF.
Hey, I don't know if this is going to happen, but just now, like literally just now.
What happened?
I got an email from Say Adams.
Hey, Say Adams.
I reached out to him after meeting him at the opening of the African American History Museum and said, hey, if you'd ever like to sit down and talk about what you do, I'd love to do it. And he just wrote back. So maybe
and
that's
he said,
happen.
Hell no.
Yeah, right. He's like, who?
Who are you?
Right.
What do you want from me?
Yeah. We've got to get you down here and go to the museum.
Well, yes, I'm going to wait. We're supposed to be down there. We just actually made plans, to be down there in December 14th, somewhere around there, like the weekend of that weekend.
Okay.
To see the kids and do the Christmas thing and stuff. So we'll be down there. Maybe we can see if we can sneak in. Maybe Melissa can hook us up.
Yeah, it's neat. I, you know, for what it's worth, I really hope the term Blacksonian doesn't catch on.
That's what people are calling it?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
Blacksonian. People are ridiculous.
Yeah, not cool.
It is. Anyway, it's amazing this world, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Don't say it.
I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it. Not gonna say it. Okay, so what are we not gonna do it? Wouldn't be prudent, Bill. Wouldn't be prudent.
Only the old people will understand that joke.
That's right.
Isn't that weird?
It is. It is kind of.
You start
weird.
Telling jokes that people don't get.
Okay, it's age appropriate.
Yeah.
It's
like we're in the Catskills talking to people.
If you don't remember when Cap'n Crunch only had Crunch Berries in red, you won't get this.
Yeah. Exactly. That's funny.
So hey, folks had fun with the stripes.
Yeah, I like the stripes.
It was fun, right?
Yeah, I'm opening up the latest because I haven't seen it in a day or two.
Yeah. Nicholas Govis getting some brutal stripes in there. I love Florian, the close up of the piano.
Keys.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Man, there's stripes everywhere. I like Andrew Shields' one too, of like the it's just the strips of light coming down end up looking like stripes in different directions.
Yeah.
Stripes are apparently they're everywhere, Jeffrey.
I'm going to assume it's Ty, T-I-G-H-E, Michael Ty, like Kevin Ty from Emergency.
There's a guy named Kevin Ty on Emergency.
Randolph Mantooth and Kevin Ty, Emergency.
Hold on a second. Have you seen Designated Survivor?
I have not, but I've heard it's good. Don't tell me anything.
Okay.
I've heard it's good.
Good is the word you're looking for.
I'm a big fan of Kiefer.
I like Kiefer too, and
damn
I
it,
love
Bill.
The idea of that. Did you ever read, just a quick aside, did you ever read the Tom Clancy novels where that happens?
No.
There's the end of one of the Tom Clancy novels with Jack Ryan. He's national security advisor.
Yeah.
The vice president steps down. They nominate him as VP. And as he's walking down the tunnel underneath the Capitol to be sworn in front of a joint session, this Japanese pilot, they just had a war with Japan in the book,
right?
Flies a 747 into the Capitol, kills everyone but him. And that's the end of the book. And the next book is basically the beginning of Designated Survivor, like him trying to figure out like, okay, this just happened. Now what?
Right.
Wow. And it's, if you're interested in that topic, you should go read whatever the book is. I'll figure out what it is and
find out
there.
Anyway, Michael Ty. Aerial view of a tractor. I love that photograph. Love it.
Oh, I see. Yeah. How is
great?
It up there?
Is that drone? Are you in a plane? Are you Superman? Michael, are you Superman?
Dun, 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 dun.
Matthew Stodden. Did you see that one? Look at that with the OTP spelled out in drops.
Oh, look at him.
Is that cool?
Fancy.
Right. I love it. Who else? Bobby Tingle, stripes on a wedding.
Is that I like wedding Bobby dress? Ellis's one of the guy laying down on the track field with the stripes underneath him.
Yep. Peter Evans. I gotta connect with you, Peter. We keep saying that. Let's write that down and actually make something happen.
You and Pevins should make it happen.
What?
Pevins? I just like saying Peter Evans.
Arnie Diekman? Stripes and Reflections in London. That's a terrific shot with the bicycle and the is that a black cab? I
like
love
the,
that.
The London black cabs.
Yeah, that's terrific. Matthew Zhu just screaming down the highway.
Would you have gone more contrasty with that picture you were just talking about, the Mr. Dykeman's picture?
No, I like it. I like it that way.
You're right.
It feels how I imagine London would feel, never having been there.
It feels a little like that.
Yeah.
In certain places.
Yeah. So well done. Millie, Stripes, those are kind of neat with the wood.
Still got to ask her about her band.
Right. What really happened to Vanilli? Millie. Like, she's never heard that before. She's just rolling her eyes at us right now.
She's just like, I haven't heard that since 1989.
Right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay. So, fantastic job, everyone. Really well done. Keep them coming. Love seeing them. Yeah. Yeah. Bounce. How about bounce for the next
boing,
one?
Boing, 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 boing,
boing. Boing,
sure,
boing.
Bounce.
You know, I was looking at the post-debate bounce.
Oh, is that where you came from?
I don't know. Actually, no. Sylvia thought of this. Sylvia said, I said, Sylvia, I need an assignment for this week's On Taking Pictures because she listens at 10.
Of course she
listens.
Does.
She's like, how about bounce?
That's a good one.
Bounce it is.
Kids got skills with a Z.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this came after a discussion. I was vetoed about getting a hairless cat.
No, hairless cat is not good.
I wanted to get a hairless cat and name it Mr. Peaches.
What? Hairless cats are freaky. You really like that?
I think they're so awesome.
Oh, that's so strange. You've got issues,
here,
my friend.
Here, Mr. Peaches. Here, Mr. I even made up a song about him.
Peaches.
Which I will not sing. Right. It works, right? It works.
Yeah, it could work.
Anyway,
it could work.
Vetoed.
Smart people in your household.
That's right. No. All right. You wanna talk about our photographer of the week? This is good stuff.
You like this?
Thank you, Jim Azevedo. Yeah.
Fred Lyon is our photographer.
I don't know this. I spent probably an hour and a half going through his stuff, and
I was looking at this stuff, and I was thinking to myself, my God, this sounds so familiar, and I still have not placed where I've seen it before and why. I mean, black and white, he's known for this series from San Francisco from way back in the day, as it were.
Man, it's so good.
Yeah, right?
It's so good. It's so good.
The dude is 91 years old.
Yeah.
Still back around. He's been shooting since the early 40s. News, architecture, advertising, wine, food. He likes shooting food and food. The golden years of the magazine publishing.
Hey, look, a food truck.
Yeah, he's right. He was in Life and Vogue and everything. So this guy has been around, and man, there's something about these black and white shots of San Francisco, especially.
They're gorgeous.
Are fantastic.
They're absolutely gorgeous.
Especially the ones where, man, all these ones where guys are shooting on the Golden Gate Bridge. There's the painter on the Golden Gate Bridge climbing up the thing. You and I were talking earlier before the show, because I'm going out west later next week, and I'll be in Zion National Park, and there's this hike called this place called Angel's Landing,
mm-hmm.
where to get to the top of it, you basically walk across a 3-foot wide piece of sandstone with a cable with a chain.
Yeah, there are chains
into the rock.
And to be clear, Bill, the chain is not all
tight
along the entire
know,
climb.
It's
only in certain places.
Yep. And on either side is a good 1,500-foot drop.
Oh, at least.
So basically, you slip, you fall, you die.
Yeah.
But there's this picture of this painter on the Golden Gate Bridge climbing up the cable with seemingly no harness.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, maybe he does, but the point is that is not a situation I could ever do. No, thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you.
Yeah. So the wiki entry, the trail to Angel's Landing is 2.4 miles long, begins at the grotto drop off, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
A series of 21 steep switchbacks are the last hurdle before Scout Lookout. Scout Lookout is generally the turnaround point for those who are unwilling to make the final summit push to the top of Angel's Landing. The last half mile is strenuous and littered with sharp drop-offs and narrow paths. Chains to grip are provided for portions of the last half mile to the top at 5,790 feet.
Yeah. No, thank you.
So enjoy that, Bill.
So, hey, did you see the picture of the creepy clown in here holding like a xylophone?
Is it at his site or is it one of the
other? Yeah, on his site.
Okay.
Yeah, in the San Francisco part. Go into, I guess, the San Francisco portfolio and scroll down a bit. There's a picture of this clown who's freaky as all get up.
Oh, yes.
I don't like that at all.
Yeah. That's like, it looks like Walton Goggins in a clown outfit.
Yeah.
So number 30.
There's something about the tone of these pictures.
They're terrific. I just put the link in Skype for the Amazon, for the book on Amazon. San Francisco, A Portrait of a City, 1940 to 1960. Currently $28, if you want to add that in.
I'll tell you that one of the reasons why I wanted this new camera is, I mean, the insane, 14 plus stops of dynamic range it supposedly has, was to start trying to shoot some digital black and white that had the same tonality of good black and white film, which is something that's very hard to do on lesser cameras. So, it's going to be interesting. I look at these and they are the thing that I want to climb, beautiful stuff.
Yeah. Really gorgeous. I like this a lot. The other, you've got an interview in here. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. There's a few good interviews in here. In the rumpus.
Yeah. And that shot in the article of the flashlight with the silhouette of the car. Oh my God. That's like some LA Confidential kind of,
straight film noir, right?
Oh my God. So beautiful.
It's like right down
so
in the middle.
So beautiful. Yeah.
Let me put a new link. This is Fred Lyon, San Francisco on Amazon. Yeah, it's
there are, let's see, a limited edition portfolio of 15 silver gelatin 16x20 prints of Fred's most iconic San Francisco images in a clamshell, handcrafted clamshell box. I wonder what that little jewel runs.
$17 million. Doesn't it seem like people who grew up on the West Coast versus people who grew up in the East Coast, it really is a different thing. Do you have a different feel to day-to-day life on the East Coast versus the West Coast?
Oh, yeah.
You notice that?
Okay. Yeah. It,
can you describe it, being somebody who's lived on both now?
Ooh, can I describe it? From what point of view? Because there certainly are, the things they say about seasons is certainly a factor. And seeing the leaves start to change and feeling a chill in the air and the days are starting to get a little blustery and that kind of thing.
How do you feel about that? Do you like that change?
I love it. I love it. Come on. Did I mention I love it? Yeah, it's fantastic.
Hey, by the way, I just found a KQED documentary where they're sitting talking to Fred Lyon.
Oh, yeah. Add that in.
It is 54 minutes long.
Yeah. Add that in, please.
So I will add it to the show notes, to the official show notes. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean,
didn't mean to cut you up.
Fashion is different here. I mean, one of the first things I noticed even before I moved here was the shoes. You guys have amazing shoes. People are fascinated with shoes here.
I never noticed the difference between that. Wait, people don't like shoes in LA?
I don't know that they do or they don't, but in where I was anyway, maybe because I wasn't in,
the cool
LA
kid
proper
zone.
Or San Francisco proper, whatever. There's a lot of athletic shoes, casual shoes, but you can tell what season it is here by the type of shoes that people wear.
Okay, sure.
And I think that's fascinating. I would love to do a whole series on shoes, but I don't know if that's going to happen because how do you ask somebody if you can just take a picture of their shoes?
I think Mr. Cunningham had it pretty good. So,
well,
I think you just kind of have to be a goofy, questionably guy in a blue smock with effeminate way about him, and just say that's fabulous. Can I take a picture of those? Worked for him, right?
It's true. It's true.
Isn't it interesting how certain people can, especially a street photographer, can be...
Did you think he was... I didn't think he was that effeminate.
Not drastically so, but he had a flair about him, didn't he?
I would say
I didn't mean it as a derogatory thing. It was just a descriptive thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they definitely had a flair about him. Panache, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Isn't it amazing, though, how some people, especially with street stuff, are disarming and some people are not. And then some people who are not purposefully, like Bruce Davidson and these guys, don't want to be, right? I want to be anti.
Yes.
I want to attack you, you know, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Kind of cool.
All right. So Fred Lyon.
Now I got to go wait for USPS to show up with my camera.
Right. Yeah. So the
and
next
FedEx
time
to show up with my lens.
Next time we talk,
we'll be using more hard drive space than I ever thought possible.
Right.
You know, right. Let me ask you a question as a little roundup here thing at the end. What do you think of the idea of starting a brand new, fresh Lightroom catalog?
Love it. I think you should.
You like that idea?
Yeah. Okay. I think you should.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's my new thought.
Hey, I might have a favor to ask of our California listeners.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. you're off the hook, Wadman. Don't worry about it.
They can't send you In-N-Out Burger. It doesn't travel well.
All right. Well, thanks for listening and have a good week. No. I'm looking at, we have a dishwasher, and the dishwasher is the KitchenAid Superba from many, many years ago. And I would like to get a new bottom rack. And they have one in Van Nuys, but I don't know if the guy ships it because he said
come
it's
on,
local.
He's got to be able to ship. Oh, so you want somebody to pick it up and then deliver it to you?
Not deliver it, mail it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah, so get on a plane and carry this thing. I'm going to find out. I'm sending the guy an email today, but it's beautiful condition, and
the dishwasher as it is.
Yeah,
the rack. Oh,
the bottom
okay.
rack is you know the what do you call that stuff? Like the soft touch, the goo is starting to is chipped off, and
you know they
some
still sell
through.
Superbas. I wonder if you could. Let me ask you a question though. How about this? How about cutting off the rubber, cleaning it up, and then dipping it in rubber to
it in plastic coat?
Yeah,
yeah, but you can't find that sort of minty blue green anymore.
Oh, so it's the color that you have in it. Oh, like you couldn't match a color. Come on, paint boy.
Yeah, I probably could. Anyway,
you know, that would be fun to do as just an experiment to see if you could pull it off.
I'm going to find out.
Building something from scratch. That'd be cool.
I'm going to find out.
All right, go do your thing.
Yeah. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
Yep. At Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris on Twitter and Instagram and whatnot. And 347-687-9411. Oh, one last thing.
Yeah.
I was a guest on a podcast last Thursday, so if you want to hear me talk about nothing to do with photography,
then tune in next week.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. My friend Bianca has her new Fitless podcast, which I've helped her set up, where she is going and doing a workout with different people and then discussing it afterwards and kind of being silly and funny, but also educational and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I took her and taught her how to use a rowing machine last week. And we had a good conversation about it afterwards. I will put a link in the show notes, fitlesspodcast.com. However, I will also say, you're going to love this, Jeffrey. So we go to the gym to go do this show. We're sitting down stretching. There are two rowing machines. A guy's on one of them. We kind of wanted to have both of them open so we could sit next to each other and I could talk her through it. But there was a guy on one of them rowing really nice. And so we were like, well, fine. I'll go on this one. I'll show you how to do it. And then you can try. We'll go on one of them. So as I'm doing this whole thing, explaining everything to her, the guy finishes up. And so she starts talking to him. Hi, you know, it's my first time on a rowing machine. And I said, oh, you row really nice. Did you row crew when you were younger? Because the guy's probably late 50s, early 60s.
This is the Olympic guy, right?
Yeah. He was on the Olympics.
Yeah. So Bill's hanging out with Olympians now.
I was like, what? Yeah. So anyway. The guy is an Olympic rower, and his name is Mark something, and he was super sweet.
Was it Mark Spitz?
I don't think so. Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, so that was
could
fun.
Have been.
You never know who you're going to meet. 347-687-9411. What?
Have you ever thought about doing a series at the gym, like of just like some of the regulars? That could be a fun series.
It could be. I don't know that they'd let me bring a camera in there, but I'm sure if I asked and make it a thing. I will tell you that the photography on all the posters, they wouldn't let you bring a DSLR in,
but they might let you bring a medium format camera.
That's right. The seat opens doors. It's like it pays to be. You know, step one that I do when I get this camera after I make sure everything's working is to tape it up so that no one knows what it is, right?
Right. Do you insure your gear? Let's talk about insurance next time.
Okay, yeah. I can talk about that because I do now have insurance where I didn't before.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
In fact, I got to call the place to make them change it.
All right.
Yeah, let's talk about insuring. See you later.
Next week, tune in. More good stuff. Have a great week. Thank you for listening. Join the group, Google Plus group. It's really the only thing Google Plus is good for is the on taking pictures.
I think a lot of people would actually agree with that.
It's probably
true. I think Google is actually, I got an email.
They sent out a press release. So have a great week. It is fall. Hopefully it's nice where you are, and be good to each other. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out. So I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long. It's clear to me the this way, say what you wanna say. I know what you will say. We'll